This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
In 2006, the body of 27-year-old Justine Swartz Abshire was found on Taylorsville Road in Orange County. The cause of death was listed as 113 blunt trauma injuries. Courtney Stewart is a senior editor at The Hook online at readthehook.com, and she joins me live in studio. She's the author of this week's cover story of The Hook and on The Hook. And
hey, Coy.
Hey, where are you? What? Oh, you're on that mic. Okay, we'll get you over there. Sorry about that. Try it one more time.
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now.
I can't. Okay.
Can you hear me? Are your earphones working?
No.
Oh, goodness.
I can hear you, though.
I think you're plugged in over here. Make sure. Oh, no, you're plugged in right there. Let's make sure we're set up here. We have thank you, Leon. I'm not quite sure what's going on. We want to make sure. Here we go. Is that working?
That's working.
Oh, there we go. Okay. Somebody was messing with the buttons before I got in here. Courtney Stewart is a reporter at The Hook, and she's the author of this week's cover story, Fight for Justice. Courtney, remind us of the details of this case.
Oh, sure. Okay. So this was a case that goes back to November of 2006, when the first reports were that a 27-year-old kindergarten teacher taught up at Emerald Hill Elementary School in Culpeper was found on Taylorsville Road, which is in Orange County, but right near the Greene County line near Barbersville. And she reportedly was found lying in the road by her husband sometime after 1 o'clock, between 1 and 2 in the morning. It appeared to be a hit and run. That's how it was first reported. But as the case has unfolded and as details have come out, it's, I think, become increasingly hard to believe that that's what happened to her. And the parents, Justine's parents, have been increasingly vocal over the past 4 years, starting about 6 months after her death, their suspicions about her husband, Eric.
So it's just an amazing story. Now, this has gotten some national attention, and you and I have talked on this program before about this case.
Yeah.
So what is the very latest? They have filed a civil suit against their former son-in-law, against Eric Abshire? Is
yes.
that right?
Yes, but not only against Eric Abshire, but against as many as 9 other people. And they've named 4 people in the suit, and then they say 6 unnamed co-conspirators. And they say that this group of people conspired to cause her death. And the suit, which was filed in Nottoway County, which is several hours away, doesn't offer details exactly about what they think these people conspired to do or what they did do. But that, I guess, you know, would come out as the case progresses.
Now, this is not a criminal case.
No, this is a civil suit. The criminal investigation is also still ongoing and very active, according to police. But because you have statute of limitations, if they wanted to have the opportunity to file a civil suit, since there's been no arrest, they had to start meeting a set of deadlines. And they've had some, I think, clever lawyering is what somebody called it, which is how this news of this civil suit is just coming out now. Because usually people think of a civil suit and think that there's a 2-year statute of limitations. But they have managed to sort of keep this under wraps until recently.
Yeah. Why file in Nottoway County? Can you do that? And why there?
Yeah, my understanding from talking to legal experts is that in Virginia, you can file a civil suit in any jurisdiction. It doesn't have to be the place of residence or where a crime or a tort allegedly occurred.
And so Nottoway County, and I read in your article that Nottoway County is down one judge.
Yeah,
so
well, that's what I
cases
heard.
Are moving very, very slowly there. Is
right.
That right?
Yeah.
So that might be another reason why they went to Nottoway. Is that?
Yeah, my impression from talking to people outside the case is that they would not have wanted this thing to be rushed along because they really wanted the criminal case to go forward, and they did not want this to distract from that. And so they had reason to want to meet these deadlines, but not have it sort of become headline news and not alert the people who are the focus.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so it's interesting. I didn't know that you could do these things.
So why so many people, and we're talking with Courtney Stewart of The Hook, the phone lines are open for you. Your thoughts on this case, 977 1070. Why so many people in this suit? I mean, it's not only Eric, it's members of his family, it's friends, and as you point out, it's six or seven people that aren't even named yet.
Right, that they say that they are hoping that, you know, they will find out who those people are and they can serve them. And they have months still to serve. The two of the people who are named have not yet been served, and then the rest of these people haven't even been named.
What's the guiding idea of the civil suit? I mean, give us an idea of where the Swartzes are coming from. Justine's parents are coming from. What's their belief?
Well, they wouldn't go into the details about what each of these people has done to make them believe that they're guilty, but they did talk about sort of some strange behavior and then these inconsistencies that make the story that they've been told very, very hard to swallow.
And essentially they allege that Eric and these other folks conspired to murder Justine.
Right. That's what it's.
And they're alleging that the motivation would be insurance money. There was over $1 million of insurance money, right?
Right. Over $1 million.
And the only benefactor, the only beneficiary was her husband, Eric.
Her sister was the beneficiary for one policy, but he was the beneficiary for the million plus that we're talking about.
Yeah. Which we've confirmed, you confirmed in your story, that that's money he has tried to get.
Part of it. He tried to get a $150,000 policy she had through the National Education Association, but she was also paying a $375 extra, $3.75 a month for double indemnity for accidental death. And so this.
And that's where the big money was.
Right. And Eric and Justine had been married less than 6 months when she died. And so he had become the beneficiary when he became her husband, is my understanding of this. So she had 5 months of married life and then died. And then this policy, which is actually worth $300,000, he did not make a claim on that until December of 2008, which is 1 month after the 2-year statute of limitations on a civil suit. Normally, you know, that's where it would have ended.
And that's part of the alleged conspiracy, that he waited until after he could be sued civilly and then went after the insurance.
It's
insurance
not contained
money.
In the suit. It's just sort of interesting math. And the suit is very vague, I have to say. I mean, there's very little that you can take away from it other than they allege this conspiracy and they name these people.
Yeah.
And
legally, at this point, the civil case is really, I guess you could just say it's a tool for investigation.
Right. At this point. And that's what the attorney for Eric Abshire's brother, Jesse, says, that, you know, that they're using it as a fishing expedition, that they're wanting to get these people under oath and do depositions.
Yeah.
But, you know, you can't. They're trying to get it tossed. They're trying to have the venue switched to something local and convenient.
Yeah.
And they're
Sometimes you catch big fish when you go fishing. We're talking with Courtney Stewart of The Hook. We'll take a quick break, and when we get back, let's talk about some of these inconsistencies and things that don't really just line up and don't make sense from the viewpoint of Justine's parents that started the night that she was killed. We'll learn more about this in just a few minutes. This is Charlottesville Right Now.
Go to bed with no price on your head. No, no.
Don't do it.
Don't do it. Don't do the crime if you can't do the time.
It's 20 minutes after 5 o'clock here in Central Virginia. It's 66 degrees in Charlottesville. Let's rejoin our conversation with Courtney Stewart. Her latest cover story for The Hook, online at readthehook.com and available in the red boxes throughout Central Virginia, is called Fight for Justice. It's an update on the Justine Swartz Abshire unsolved murder from 2006. Courtney, take us to that night when she was killed. What's Eric's story, and what have you learned about his story? And then sort of pick up and tell us more about when her parents got there and what they experienced that night.
Well, you want the I think starting with the parents, they get this call at 3 o'clock in the morning from Eric's brother, Jesse, telling them that Justine is dead. So they're awakened in the middle of the night. This is, as anyone can imagine, the worst possible call you could ever receive. So they're, you know, getting up out of bed, having to figure out how to get from Chattanooga, Tennessee, where they were living at the time, to Greene County. So they catch a flight, they get in, and they go out to the house, this house on Fredericksburg Road, and they start hearing sort of what happened, or what they're first being told that happened, which is that, according to Eric, he and Justine argued the night before. She had come home from taking a master's degree class in at UVA. She was getting her master's degree. He had been visiting his mother, who was sick in the hospital. When he came back, they were together briefly early in the evening. Then he gets a call that he needs to go back to the hospital, so he goes back to the hospital. Then when he comes home at midnight or 12:30, they get into this argument because she, according to Eric, says he won't talk about his feelings and he's closed down. And so he says, leaves. You know, he says something like, sometimes I need to be alone. And she says, well, sometimes I need to be alone. And she gets in her car, he says, and takes off. So she's gone maybe 20 or 30 minutes, according to his time frame, when he gets a call from her saying, my car is broken down on Taylorsville Road, which her parents say is a place that she had never been before. She may have driven down it once or twice, but it was not a place where she would have normally been. So he sets out, although it takes him 10 or 15 minutes, he says, to find his shoes and get his motorcycle helmet, which is a weird detail that he chooses on this cold November night with the temperature about 35 degrees to ride on his motorcycle to go pick her up with this broken down car. So
Did he have a car that he could have taken instead?
Well, he says his explanation for that is that he had traded, because he was so stressed about his mother and her illness, he had gone and gotten his motorcycle out of storage that night, left his car at the storage unit, and then so he could ride his motorcycle as sort of a way to unwind.
Okay.
So that's his explanation. So he has his motorcycle.
I have to say, just as an aside here, if you read your story, it's amazing that he's always got an answer for. He always has some excuse or some convenient explanation for all of these, just this whole constellation of very strange things that don't add up.
Right. Well, and he would say he always has an explanation because he's telling the truth. But when you really start looking at the details, it just is it's really hard to understand how this could have happened. So he gets what is shown to be just more than a 10-second phone call from her. And somehow she's able to relate to him in that time where she is, that her car is broken down, and that he needs to come get her.
And the records show that that's like a 10-second conversation
I think 13 seconds is. So off he goes on the motorcycle. He's heading down this road, which is about 5 miles from their house, and he sees something up ahead in the road, and he thinks it's an animal, but as he gets closer, he realizes it's Justine, and she's lying there. And so he says he then, you know, stops his bike, gets off, sees that she is lying there in the road. He doesn't know if she's dead or alive, so he sits down and cradles her for 15 to 18 minutes and does not go immediately for help. He says he's so stunned and horrified.
And he's got a cell phone in his pocket that he never uses, right?
Right. He has a cell phone in his pocket that he doesn't think to use. So instead, about 1:57, he starts banging sometime right around there, he starts banging on doors and he calls. He doesn't call. He has the neighbor. He has a resident. Call 911 at 1:57. So from the time of her call, which I think was 1:19 to him, that lasted 10 seconds.
Yeah.
We're talking close to 40 minutes. So that's very hard to understand. Then there are some other bizarre
things. I just tell you my 2 cents?
Mm-hmm.
I just can't buy that. I mean, a man finds his wife lying in the road and he doesn't dial 911 on the cell phone that's in his pocket? I just don't buy it. That's just my opinion. I'm not a lawyer, but no. I just don't buy that at all.
It's a tough one. The other tough thing to understand is why her car that was broken down started up immediately for police.
And wasn't actually broken down when they went to it.
It started right up. Two independent mechanics could find nothing wrong with it. The trunk was open. The driver's side door was open. The keys were in the ignition. She had left her coat and her purse in the car when she set out walking down this dark road at 1:30 in the morning or whatever. So this is, you know, her cell phone, I guess, was it?
And her diamond was missing from her ring, right?
Right. Her diamond.
I mean, she'd been robbed. She was robbed.
Well, that it appears. That
yeah.
Either that or the stone was knocked out by the impact of whatever happened to her.
Yeah. But there was no evidence that she'd been hit by a car. There was just evidence that she'd been beaten to death.
And that's really the place where you just get into, okay, none of this can have happened the way it it has first been told to us, because she doesn't have any evidence of being hit by a car, at least while standing up. So she has no.
Because there are telltale signs if you're hit by a car. There's like this recognizable mark on your legs,
mark,
right?
Yeah, it's called a strike point or a strike mark where the bumper hits, and it's usually in your legs.
Yeah.
Makes sense. And so you would have this horizontal injury, either broken bones or severe bruising or whatever. She does not have that, but she does have 113 blunt trauma injuries, 23 to her head alone. Her pelvis is broken in a couple of places. I mean, she's been battered to death. I mean, something so hideous has happened to her. And so I guess, you know, the police come, the first responders arrive. They interview Eric at the scene, and he gives them this story. And so Mike Jones, who's a Virginia State Police special agent who's heading the investigation, says that they spent the next several hours trying to verify his story. And his words were, with no success. They weren't able to, you know, follow. They weren't able to corroborate what he was telling them. So then they go back, you know, and by then it's, I guess, morning or next day. And they're talking to him again.
We're talking with Courtney Stewart of The Hook. Can you stay with us for a few minutes?
Yeah, sure.
We're going to have to break for local news and weather. When we get back, we'll get more details about the unsolved murder of Justine Schwartz Abshire. Coming up after a break for local news and weather. This is Charlottesville Right Now. We're talking with Courtney Stewart, senior editor at The Hook, online at readthehook.com. She is live in studio. We're talking about this week's cover story, which just hit the red boxes, and you can read it online, Fight for Justice, the very latest on the murder of Justine Schwartz Abshire. She was found on Taylorsville Road in Orange County on a cold November night in 2006, just over 4 years ago. The cause of death was described as 113 blunt trauma injuries. Larry is on the line in Charlottesville. Larry, thank you for your patience. You go right ahead.
First of all, I just want to comment on the fact that if I came up on my wife or girlfriend in this situation, the very first thing I would have done was dial 911. And I'm kind of late coming in on the story. I was not in the car, but has this person been asked to take a lie detector test? And if so, did he decline to do it, or has he taken it?
You know, I think he was asked. I don't think he did, but I think that was on his lawyer's advice. But I could be wrong about that. That may have changed. It's been actually a couple of years since I've really been able to speak with him. He didn't return my calls for this article.
Well, I'm just like everybody else. Nothing adds up with this story whatsoever. And it just, when I heard it initially on the TV, and after going through all what I read, it was very obvious to me the guy was guilty. So anyway, I'm just warning about that.
Larry, thank you very much. Appreciate the call. We got a line open at 977-1070. We're talking with Courtney Stewart of The Hook, an update on the unsolved murder of Justine Schwartz Abshire. So, Courtney, take us now. We've talked about Eric's story, which the police have been unable to corroborate.
That's what they said.
His version of events that night.
Mm-hmm.
Take us to that night when her parents got there.
Well, they arrived the next day because they had to get a flight. They were in Tennessee and they had to fly in. So they work that out, and they arrive and get to the house out in Greene County about 2:30. And when they get there, I guess at first Eric was speaking with police. They didn't have a chance to talk to him, but they said they really pretty quickly kind of got a weird vibe, not just from Eric when he was done speaking, but from a number of family members and friends of Eric's. When he was done speaking with police, I guess he briefly greeted them long enough for them to try to comfort him.
Yeah.
And then he went into his bedroom, and he was in there with the door shut for about 3 hours with various friends.
Yeah, he wasn't alone, was he?
No, they said that there were people going in and out, that, you know, his friends and his immediate family were in there, but they were not. And then they said people started cleaning the house. Somebody said, let's go get a vacuum cleaner. And so somebody went, got a vacuum cleaner, and they said there was this cleaning going on. And meanwhile,
and the family's just sitting there in the kitchen.
They're sitting in the kitchen by themselves for a good part of this time. I mean, this is the day that they have discovered that their child is dead. And this is... These are their in-laws.
I mean, I got to tell you, when I was reading your article, That was the creepiest part for me, was that the parents rush to their dead daughter's home from Tennessee. They get there. They try to talk to their son-in-law, and he just sort of shrugs him off and goes into his room. And his family and friends go in and out of that room, and they're sitting by themselves in the kitchen for hours.
Eating cold takeout food and just like shocked, stunned. I mean, just, I think...
And these same people that are going in and out of the room talking to Eric are rushing around trying to clean the house.
Trying to clean the house. And then they said people...
It's just weird.
They found out that Eric had been gone with his cousin, Mark Madison, and another person whose name I don't know, that they had been gone from the house for about 4 or 5 hours that morning after leaving the scene of Justine's death. And that they didn't know what they'd gone into Charlottesville for some period of time. They don't know why. And so they just start feeling like, you know, something's very weird. And finally, later that afternoon, after he's been in his room for about 3 hours, they finally say, we've got to talk to Eric. And they go in and they wanted to talk about starting to make arrangements to bury their daughter. And so they agreed pretty quickly on the funeral home. But then they said in the next day or two, he really stopped showing any interest. He had no opinion on the service. He had no opinion on anything. The only thing they said he cared about as far as burial goes was that he wanted her to wear her favorite jacket. And I don't know if that happened to be the jacket that was left in the car or if that was a different jacket.
Yeah.
But he wanted her to be wearing her gray coat when she was cremated. He didn't want any of her personal effects back. He actually didn't end up wanting the ring, her wedding, the engagement band without the stone. He didn't want that back because he said without the stone, it wasn't really, you know, the ring that he had given her. And so it didn't have the same sentimental value. And these are newlyweds.
Hasn't it been confirmed that he actually slept with another woman during this time?
Yeah. So this is something that ABC Primetime Crime did a year-long investigation that they capped with an hour-long episode in July of 2008. And as part of that, they did this kind of undercover recording of the one-year vigil up in Orange. And so they taped Steve Swartz, Justine's father, talking to Eric. And in that conversation, he acknowledged that had happened. And Steve Swartz says that happened before they had even left to go home to Tennessee.
The parents.
The parents, yeah. And so...
But Eric has an excuse for that,
well,
too.
Well,
he
says that he was grief struck and intoxicated, and that, you know, he had never been unfaithful to her, but that he just lost his mind from the pain, and so that was where this behavior.
We're talking with Courtney Stewart. You can read this article online at readthehook.com or pick it up in one of the red boxes. The Hook just hit newsstands, an update on the unsolved murder of Justine Swartz Abshire. And we learn from your article that the family has filed a civil suit against their son-in-law, some of his family members, and some friends that I'm assuming were some of the same people going in and out of the room that day.
Yeah, well, I mean, at this point, the suit names Eric. It names the mother of his two children.
His ex-wife.
I don't think it's an ex-wife. I think it's just the mother of the children.
I don't know that
they were ever married.
Okay.
His cousin, Mark Madison, and his brother, Jesse Abshire. And then one to six unnamed co-conspirators.
Is the belief of the alleged conspiracy of this murder conspiracy, is the belief that this civil suit might put the pressure on them and somebody's going to crack?
Assuming
that they have something to do with it, of course. This is what's alleged.
I mean, I think so. I mean, I think if you have somebody coming after you for $5 million, and it's $5 million against Eric, but it's also $5 million against each one of these people.
Yeah.
And then an additional... 300.
Now, what they allege in their suit is some type of insurance fraud, basically, that she had an accidental death policy.
They don't get into that allegation in the suit yet. I mean, it's cursory. I mean, it states the facts of the case that she died and that all it says really is on information and belief that these people conspired to take her life.
But obviously that would be the alleged motivation.
That's
because over $1 million of an insurance policy sitting there. So does this guy have any kind of history with insurance fraud or dealing with getting insurance money?
Well, he's got, he has some history with that. And even as recently as May of 2009, after all this stuff has happened, I noticed in his bankruptcy filing, he declared bankruptcy in 2009, that he had a motorcycle accident. I don't know if it was the month of May, but he listed that he collected $4,700 in cash from that accident in May, and the filing was May 15th, so sometime in the first 2 weeks, but that his house was burglarized sometime also in that same 2 weeks, and $3,100 in cash was taken. So I'm not sure how much
that
overlapped.
And then he files bankruptcy.
And then he filed for bankruptcy on the 15th. So, you know, right there you have something that to me looked really, really odd. And I don't know if the burglar has been caught or if any of that money was ever recovered. But I found it interesting.
Yeah, it's amazing. The phone lines are open, 977-1070. Your thoughts about this case, which the Virginia State Police investigation is still ongoing, right?
It is. And they've had an investigative grand jury going up in Orange for a long time, like over a year. And that is sort of a special tool that prosecutors can use where they subpoena witnesses, bring them in, have them testify under oath, and then that investigative grand jury can issue a direct indictment. That obviously hasn't happened, but I don't know that's off the table at this point. To the best of my knowledge, that grand jury is still impaneled. I don't know when the last time they met, though.
Yeah. God, my heart just breaks for the parents and the sister, the family of this, this young woman. I mean, 27 years old. She's obviously beaten to death by person or persons.
Yeah, something.
And there's no telling if it happened there at that site where they found her or if she was taken there. It's just so unbelievably tragic. And yet this is over 4 years ago.
Yeah. So it's hard to believe how much time can go by. And yet 4 years, the police, every time I've spoken to them, they have insisted that it's not just active, but that it's very active and that they are doing something on it every day and that they believe that this is going to be solved and that they're going to have going to have a successful prosecution come out of this.
If the parents are right and there's a number of people involved who know more than they're saying, then you would think it would be easier to solve than if it was just one person being quiet. Co-conspirators and a group of people involved, I'm guessing that it might be easier.
Yeah, I mean, I think once you get more than one person knowing something, you've more than doubled your chances of getting somebody to talk or to roll over on other people or whatever. If it is indeed the case, and I don't know, beyond the strange behavior and beyond the insurance money as potential motivation, I don't know the details that would enable them to prosecute anybody else. And I don't know I don't know what evidence they have. I mean, certainly they have more than what I've been able to find out. I mean, the police.
I want to be careful and not try to try this in the media, or I'm just sharing my thoughts on it. But in these kind of cases, doesn't it usually turn out to be the spouse? I'm not saying he's guilty, but just generally speaking, demographics and crime, doesn't it usually turn out to have been somebody close to?
I don't have the statistics off the top of my head, but I know that in the case of, of murder, it's far more likely that it's someone you know. And in the case of a murdered woman, the husband is always, looked at as a potential suspect.
Yeah, and not saying he did it, but
no, but it's
when you combine that fact with all of these other things that just make no sense at all. Mm-hmm. That I mean, at the end of the day, you can have all the quick stories and excuses in the world, but that doesn't mean it's all going to add up.
Right. Yeah.
It's amazing. So, what's the next step in this? What happens next?
Well, the next step, this civil suit. Now, there's some motions to try to get the venue changed and bring it closer. The investigation is ongoing. The criminal investigation. So I know the family is hoping that the next step in this is going to be some kind of development on the criminal side. I mean, I think they are ready and willing to go forward with the civil suit if that ends up to be their only legal recourse. But I think that they are very invested in seeing criminal justice before they're concerned about, a civil judgment. I mean, seriously, $45 million. I don't think they have any illusions that they are going to actually collect that money. I think what they want to do, and they
was the same thing with Nicole Simpson's family. They knew they weren't going to get the money.
They just do not want him or whoever's responsible of those, the people that they've named. They don't want anyone profiting from her death, and they feel like this is the only way to make sure that there cannot be a profit for anyone.
Now, Eric, who is the husband, who's I guess the obvious suspect here, and you really don't have one. He's he had said at one point that he would in no way seek to profit from her death, and yet you confirmed in your story that he did try to go after some of that, file for some of that insurance
money. He had said several times, he's denied that any knowledge of this $1 million He's always said, "What are you talking about? That, you know, I don't know. I know nothing about that." He has admitted that he knew about this $150,000 policy, but all along he said, "I don't want to." You know, everybody thinks I'm after the money. I want my wife back. I don't want this money. And also, you know, he always said, "You know, you can check. I haven't done anything to get this money." Well, when he said that, that was true. He hadn't done anything. But in December 2008, he did. He filed, and this was before his bankruptcy. He went ahead and tried to collect on this policy. And I guess, unfortunately for him, Steve Swartz, Justine's father, had already disputed every insurance policy so that if a claim came in, nothing could be paid out on it.
So they alerted the father, "Hey, your former son-in-law is trying to get some insurance money from your daughter's death."
I mean, he's a force, that father. He's as any father would be, I think. He's never, ever going to rest.
You can't. That's your child.
And Heidi as well. I mean, they are both just really determined to make sure that they see this through and that they, you know, get a resolution.
Well, let's hope that they get justice. Let's hope that this young woman gets justice and that, you know, her. And it's the same thing with Morgan Harrington. I mean, what's the latest on that? Because I know you're following that story, too.
You know, the latest thing that I heard was that they took a caravan from Roanoke up through here, stopped by the Copley Road Bridge, and then went on to Fairfax. I was at Reed's before I came over here, and I noticed the flyer with the composite image of the attacker. So I know that people are still putting things up around town, and that is still, actually there was a guy looking at it as I walked past, and I thought, good, you know, people are still paying attention to this. But as far as developments in the investigation, I mean, there's been nothing that I've been able to find out. They've made no announcements. And I think the parents are just determined to try to keep the story in people's minds so that people don't become complacent and so that people keep looking for who's responsible. It's, you know, that person is out there.
Courtney Stewart is the senior editor at The Hook, online at readthehook.com. Check out her latest cover story, Fight for Justice. It's an update on the Justine Swartz Abshire unsolved murder from 2006. Courtney, thank you so much.
Thanks, Coy.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit SeavillePodcast.com for more.